Welcome back for another episode of Clean Tech Talk, where we at Clean Technica interview clean tech leaders from around the world. With topics ranging from electric cars to climate change communication, you can listen to our full podcast series by visiting our website at cleantechnica.com.
Hi, welcome back to Clean Tech Talks. I'm your host, Michael Bernard, and my guest today is Arthur Erickson with Helio. Arthur, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I am glad to be chatting with you about drones, ag, and all things in between.
It's going to be cool. Did I get Helio right, by the way?
Yeah, actually, you are one of the few people that got that right. I'm impressed.
I listened to something and I said, wait, I wanted to say Helio, but then I heard you or somebody else say it and I went, Helio, that actually makes more sense.
Yeah, it's spelled Helio, so I don't blame you for thinking that. But yeah, Helio, it's named for the Greek god of the sun, Helios, actually.
Well, and you could see helicopters, like there's a whole bunch of stuff there. It's like there's a lot of good stuff going on with that. So
that's right.
So let's start with the real basics so our guests know what the heck is going on here. Helio, drones, okay. So give us the 30-second clip on what Helio does.
Simply put, Helio is an ag tech company that designs, manufactures, and then sells crop spraying drones. So these drones are going out and they're spraying crop inputs, which take the form of fertilizers, herbicides, pesticides in general, basically anything that helps farmers increase their yields. It doesn't have to just be liquid either. We can spray liquid payloads, but also granular, aka solid payloads, for the same purposes, for improving yields and just making farms more successful. That's what we do in a nutshell.
Yeah, and that's cool. I'm really actually very interested in agricultural technologies, precision agriculture. We'll dig into a whole bunch of those intersectional things. But your background doesn't scream, I'm going to be building tractors in the sky. So tell us a bit about your background, including that weird interlude with fracking, because that's an odd progression to get here.
Oh, well, I just live in South Texas. So almost every engineer, I think, regardless of discipline, has at least one internship on a fracking rig or a fracking site.
Occupational hazard.
Yeah, so that was a brief dalliance with ONG, which, like I said, is kind of unavoidable here in Texas. But my educational background is aerospace engineering. I got a four-year degree. Well, it took me 5 years because I was doing Helio. But I got an undergrad degree, I should say, in aerospace engineering from UT Austin. And our curriculum, as you might imagine, did heavily involve drone-related technology. So I got a lot of my foundational technical skills, which I utilize at my company today, from that education. But you're right, as far as the ag stuff goes, besides growing up in and around farms and ranches with friends and family down here in Texas, I am not a farmer. I'm not a rancher officially, but it is just something that I've always been drawn to conceptually. I very much like the intersection of automation and robotics with an age-old industry, which is food production, that I think is very important and very impactful. And so I just like that the stakes are so high, I guess, for lack of a better word. Literally, you know, helping people put food on the table gets me excited.
Yeah. Now, it's an interesting thing because, you know, you started the company long enough ago that, you know, having high-capacity drones with sufficient payloads to do precision crop dusting probably wasn't something that everybody thought was reasonable. So what was your aha moment? When did you say, no, there's something here that I can do something with?
Well, that's a good point. So company started back in 2015. For the first 2 years, it was a bunch of ideation design, both in hardware and software, just getting some minimally viable products out. Just for testing, not really even to customers. So that took, I mean, it's aerospace, it's drone stuff. So it's not just like a social media app where you can just create stay up all night, create a prototype and then launch it the next day. So it took us a good year and a half or 2 years. 2017 comes by, we do a little bit of drone delivery and then we moved to the ag space, which brings us to the point you brought up. At that time in 2017, you're right, drones are extremely small. The first drone we made only had a 4-gallon payload. Which I shouldn't poo-poo that too hard because 4 gallons is still very effective. But it was definitely much smaller than I think a lot of the wider farmer market thought was feasible. And so to solve that problem, what we did as a company was we didn't try to sell it to anyone. We sold it to ourselves. So I've mentioned this before, but we were our own first customer. At least that's how I like to look at it, because for 3 years from 2017 to 2020, we just used our own drones that we designed and made as our tools for offering spray services. So that was our first revenue stream as a company. We were service providers. It's because we knew, like you pointed out, that probably this isn't mature enough for people to get on board yet. So we're going to prove it. First of all, we're going to get the hands-on experience using it to make it better, but we're also just going to prove by being our own first customer that this thing is economically viable. So that's what got us to where we are today. Like I said, about 3 years of actually being out in the field, working 10, 12 hours a day, spraying with our drones, getting through all the headaches and bugs and manufacturing defects that we ourselves created, learning from those and making the product better.
Yeah, and that's actually a really interesting sideline, because customer testing is, you know, with an app, so many apps and stuff that you alluded to, people say, well, I'd really love an app that made this better for me, so I'm going to write it, and then they have a customer base of one. But you guys have actually got a significant global market. What is it? 24% of the world's land area is under cultivation, is the land mass. So that's a non-trivial amount. Like 38% is used for cattle grazing and growing crops. And we got to put fertilizer, pesticides, herbicides on those crops, you know, and so that's an interesting space to be in. And you guys have actually got your hands dirty. Well, okay, so let's paraphrase dirty. You're actually putting electrons into a drone, standing beside a field where it might be dusty, then the drone does all the work. You know, the dirtiest you get is probably splashing of pesticides when you're filling up the drone. But that's it. So what was your biggest insight? What was your biggest aha moment out of actually running the drones yourself? What was the coolest thing?
Well, the first aha moment was, let me explain how we even got into agriculture. So
there.
We first started the company. We were doing what we called just a general purpose light to medium payload drone system. And we envisioned this was going to be like a plug and play system that was easy enough and reliable enough for anybody to utilize, typically like in a B2B sense. So we thought that this thing could be outfitted with a payload delivery mechanism for last mile delivery of medicine, food, mm-hmm. whatever, but also you could swap it out with a tank like we do with the ag here. So you could spray crops with it. We thought Helio would be just, I don't even know how to say this, providing a base platform that other people would go in and modify for their own unique business cases, right? So we did that for about 9 or 10 months. We really fell in love with ag though. And the aha moment, the reason why we even got into it was because one day we were doing a drone delivery project in Costa Rica. And I just remember we were on a bridge in a town called Cartago, which is like south of San Jose. It's a suburb of the capital down there. And I was just looking over like a small farm. I believe it was a bean field. And they were spreading fertilizers, or maybe it was pesticides, I don't even know, by hand. So I remember mm-hmm. seeing two or three laborers out there just touching the stuff with their hands, spreading it haphazardly. And they were doing so because they didn't have any other options. So mm-hmm. Central America and a lot of developing countries aren't like the US, where they have this infrastructure where you've got these awesome John Deere tractors and like all this middle management in the ag space that's willing to do this professional work for you with the right equipment and whatnot. So it just left to like the farmers themselves. I mean, like the grassroots people are out there like doing this stuff by hand because they have no other means. And so that struck me and I was like, there's got to be a better way to do this. And I think our drones are the answer. So I was like, okay, yeah, sure. There's a bunch of other cool things to do in the drone space, but ag is the one that I think we're going to have the biggest impact in. So that was the aha moment to get into ag. Now, to answer your earlier question, what epiphanies did we have along the way? Interesting question. It feels like it was more like death by a thousand cuts, or not death, but rebirth. I think it was just a fundamental humbling experience to just understand how many things could possibly go wrong with the deployment of a drone for the agricultural use cases. There are so many variables. I mean, it's a multidisciplinary product, right? You've got aerospace, you've got controls, programming, you've got the whole ag side of it, which is like a whole nother thing. I mean, people have dedicated their entire lives. I mean, human civilization has revolved around improving agriculture since the dawn of time. So there's that intermixed with aerospace and computer science. It was just humbling. I couldn't tell you there's an aha moment in those 3 years where we were spraying as a service. It was just an experience that taught me how hard this is and therefore proved to me how valuable what we were building was. The harder it got, the more I was convinced that this is something we have to continue doing.
Yeah, it's interesting because you talk about drone delivery, and you know, I looked at Zuckerberg's statement, I think in 2014 or something, saying we'll have drone delivery next year, and I said, not a chance, for this, you know, a variety of reasons, which you found out as you kind of explored the space, you know, out of line of sight drone usage, even in the wilds, requires FAA approval, and in cities, you know, come on, that's going to be not a chance. And then there's payload problems and there's range problems. Then there's last meter delivery stuff. Like, we're going to take a drone that's capable of carrying something somebody wants to get at home with a 6 or 8 foot wingspan, and we're going to hover it outside their balcony or drop it on the sidewalk outside their apartment building or put it in their backyard. You know, there's just so many interesting intersectional barriers. What about pets? What happens when Fido sees this massive thing lowering into their front yard and chase and charges it? You know, just so many barriers, which mostly don't exist in agriculture. But there's a few things in there that are interesting. So one of the people I spoke to is Grant Canary of Drone Seed. I don't know if you've met Grant or have been aware of Grant, but he has very stuff like yours, heavy lift drones, 8 foot wingspans, 120 pounds, 60 pounds of payload of seedlings in moss pucks, which very much like you guys, he has pre-programmed paths for them over burn areas in the Pacific Northwest. And he drops them in exactly the right place on pre-programmed paths, which is one of the things you guys do. So he's got actually approval to run drone swarms out of line of sight. So are you guys out of line of sight? How much FAA involvement have you had in this? I mean, there's an interesting question of the regulatory approvals there.
Yeah, so there is some leniency in the ag world. There is something that the FAA has told us they're calling, quote unquote, temporary out of line of sight flight. And it's because basically working with them for so long, we've gone back and forth on just how to craft these regulations. We're not legislatures, but of course our input matters because we're one of the most prolific applicants, right? We put in waiver applications for all of our customers. So that's at least hundreds, if not thousands at this point. So anyway, they came up with this thing, which is basically like, yeah, you're going to go over the far end of a cornfield and you might dip out of line of sight for a number of seconds, maybe a few minutes at most. That's fine as long as you demonstrate that you have enough redundancies in your automation to account for things. Like if the drone does run out of batteries on the far end and you can't intercede as the pilot and tell it to come home, is it going to automatically come home knowing that it's running out of batteries? In the case for Helio, yes. So yes, for our customers, they are allowed to be temporarily out of line of sight. So the answer is not exactly black and white. No, we don't have full beyond visual line of sight for extended missions, but we do have this temporary allowance.
And that's important because, you know, it's been a very slow progression for UAV regulatory approvals. For a long time, there were 400 feet line of sight only, single operator or a single drone, you know, et cetera, and size limitations. But your drones are awfully big. I mean, I mentioned the Grant Canary drone size. How big do yours get and how much weight are they carrying at peak?
Our biggest drone at the moment, which you can see on our site, and maybe you've seen it, is the AG-272. And it can carry about 200 pounds worth of payload. And tip to tip, it is, I think off the top of my head, just over 14 feet, tip to tip.
Oh, okay. So you're dwarfing Grant Canary's seed drones. That is quite impressive. I hadn't realized it was that big.
No, I mean, yeah. And it's bigger isn't always better. Like their seed drones are adequate for what they're trying to do with them, their use case. And seeds aren't super, super heavy. But yeah, no, we've met with Drone Seed, actually had plenty of productive conversations with them. And it's really cool what they're doing. And they are, in a lot of ways, forefathers in this space in terms of like getting those regulatory approvals before really anyone did. So yeah, I've got to shout out to Drone Seed because their 137 is definitely the basis. Their 137 waiver is the basis for everybody else's 137 waiver in the space, practically. Because I think they got theirs back in 2013, 2014 or something, but quite early.
Yeah.
I don't remember the exact day or exact year.
My memory says from talking to Grant that they had 46 people from the FAA on one call because they were like, everybody was trying to figure out, everybody at the FAA was trying to figure out what to do.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
So, yeah, and I've been looking at, I looked at FAA approval processes and stuff for a long time. I spent a bunch of time looking at the airborne wind energy space. I don't know if you know it, but use kites, generate electricity. Google's McCanny had a space there. And a lot of them, basically, they're tethered, but they're tethered drones. Mm. They're tethered autonomous vehicles. And so they have to apply for all the same regulatory stuff. There's no operators, so they have to apply for autonomous operation and stuff.
Interesting. Now,
yeah, and complete failure of a space. I've talked to some of the leaders in the space, and you know, some of them actually knew it at the time, but it's a really interesting space to do engineering in, really interesting aerospace engineering problem, just with no utility, unlike what you're doing.
It's a good tax write-off for these big companies, right? Good, well, R&D tax credit.
What I used to say about the airborne wind energy space was you scratch one of those people and you find a kite surfer. And they're all in places with great kite surfing weather. McCanny was in Hawaii, and it moved there from, I think, San Diego. But now, with the urban air mobility stuff, the electric VTOLs that are supposed to fly over children playing in schoolyards, with stuff like that folds and stuff, no path to certification. I say that if you scratch one of those people, you find an airborne wind energy person. There's a whole bunch of people from that somewhere. Space. It was hilarious. I just found, like, Joby, which is one of the big players, they started out as an airborne wind energy organization, and they failed miserably there because it's a stupid space with really fun engineering. And now they're doing this other stuff, which is a stupid space with really fun engineering and lots of money thrown at it to be stupid.
Moving people, I mean, conceptually, that's a good idea. I am very hesitant to get onto a drone that's going to transport me anywhere, but I think the idea
that's because you're a professional.
Yeah. I've seen what can go wrong. I'll say that much.
Yeah. So, but let's talk about the space, because you're intersecting in a space where flying aircraft over fields and spraying stuff, or driving tractors over fields and spraying stuff, are two existing technologies. But now you're doing it with drones. And I see, you know, there's a bunch of significant intersectional advantages of that. So why don't we start with what came before what you guys are capable of doing? What were the downsides to it?
So the big two things, right, are airborne sprayers that are manned. So you've got your helicopters and your airplanes, and then you've got your terrestrial ground sprayers, which are manned traditionally as well. So your big self-propelled sprayers made by John Deere, Case, what have you. And let's say, simply put, cost is a problem in both of those areas. Some of these new self-propelled John Deere sprayer tractors, for example, can run, well, I think new ones run upwards of $500,000 at the minimum. Mm-hmm. Used ones, maybe you can find one for like $200,000 to $300,000, a smaller one if it's 20 years old. But up front, they're very expensive. Running them, so running any of these ground sprayers, you know, per hour, you might be spending, let's say on the low end, maybe $100. But with where diesel is and just rising cost of everything, you're probably like $150, $200 per hour running those. So both, initial costs, operating costs, quite expensive. Same goes with airplanes and helicopters. I mean, we're talking anywhere from, let's say, $300,000 to $1,000,000 for one of those aircraft. And then not to mention, you've got this really expensive insurance. So typically $50,000 to $100,000 per year for those things. Danger to your life if you're a pilot. Lawsuits, because there's a lot of drift involved in that methodology of applying crop inputs. So you're a huge target. I mean, people see an airplane, they hear one coming, they hear a helicopter, they're going to call the FAA, they're going to call the EPA. I've heard that complaint thousands of times at this point from people in the space. So yeah, I don't want to meander too much on the topic, but yeah, cost is a big issue. Precision is the other big issue. And that's where drones supersede both of these traditional methods. So they're much cheaper. You could buy, let's do a quick comparison. So again, that John Deere sprayer that I mentioned, let's say it's $500,000. You could probably do, realistically, considering all factors, probably, let's say, 75 to 100 acres per hour. Now, to do that with helio drones, you would need two of our 272s, and they're about 70K each. So you're looking at, let's call it like 150 or even 200,000 to get everything. So the trailer, the batteries, the chargers, et cetera, to have the equivalent efficiency of two Clio drones up against one of these tractors. So you're already, what, 40% of the price? So you're 200K instead of 500K. So much cheaper up front. Your operating cost is probably more like 30, 40 bucks per hour versus the 150 to 200 bucks per hour for that tractor. So a quarter of the operating costs. And you can simply just get out and spray much more precisely and faster with less headache with the drones than you could with the tractor. So tractor can't go out when it's muddy out, for example. And oftentimes when it rains, that's when you have the most fungal pressure on your crops. So it rains, you have a 3 or 4 day window there to really get in there and kill that fungus before it takes 10%, 20% of your yield. You can't get out there with a tractor. Yes, you can get out there with the drones. They don't care, of course, that the ground is muddy. If you have a bunch of fence lines, tree lines, perhaps irregularly shaped corners in your field, it's going to be a hassle to get that tractor in and out of there. You're going to be running over a crop as you turn. You're going to be compacting the soil. There's so many, again, I guess I use this phrase already, but like death by a thousand cuts when you use these tractors. There are so many drawbacks. And people have only been using tractors because that's all we had. But of course, now, you know, we're talking about the drone age where yes, now there's finally a better way to do these things. So yeah, that was a long answer, but I hope that was at least a little bit insightful.
Well, I'm actually going to pull it apart a little bit more because I'm interested in soil compaction. One of the people I spoke to a year and a half ago was Karsten Temme, who is the CEO of Pivot Bio. Don't know if you know those guys or not.
Heard the name, not super familiar.
Yeah. Cool people. So different nerdy background to yours. He's a PhD, he and his partner are PhDs of agrigenetics. And so for them, their big thing was, let's reverse engineer the genetic structure of nitrogen-fixing microbes and inject them into plants. So we make plants fix their own nitrogen. And that was really, really insanely hard because they're going to genetically engineer a plant. Oh my God, that's tough. And so they're going out for coffee going, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Oh, wait, why don't we just turn the nitrogen sensor off in the microbe? The microbes are lazy, like all human beings. You know, it's like, I don't know if you've ever heard thinking fast and slow. We're lazy. If there's an easy way to do something, we're going to do it. And microbes are the same way. If they only produce nitrogen in the absence of nitrogen, they get the plant sugars and they multiply. But if we put on nitrogen in the form of ammonia-based fertilizers, you know, which is a significant problem, which I'm going to talk about a bit, then the microbes in the soil kind of go, oh, look, nitrogen. I'm just going to eat, drink, and multiply. Sure. But so what they did, they said, little switch, little genetic tweak to the microbe, dick, brew them like brewer's yeast, use them with precision agriculture techniques, coat the seeds. They grow and multiply with the plant at the roots, and they fix nitrogen from the soil constantly. So when I spoke to them, this is a year and a half ago, they had 1 million acres of corn under management. Pretty cool. Okay.
Yeah, right? Pretty cool.
Now, one of his things was, one of the advantages for his stuff was a lot fewer tractor runs over the fields. You know, because instead of doing potentially five runs with fertilizer, you could do maybe two. And so the soil compaction aspect really is a big assist for soil health and vitality over time. So you guys are doing the same thing, but in a very different way. You're avoiding that soil compaction. And now for me, I'm not an agricultural guy. I just think it's really interesting. How big a factor is that from your perspective and your clients' perspectives?
It is so contextual. It depends on the crop, the area, the equipment that you ran over the soil with.
Don't the biggest hold me hitter.
To it. Yeah, don't hold me to it, but maybe like 3 to 10% yield loss is generally what I've seen. But that in a low margin business, that's big, right? I mean,
yeah.
10% up to a 10% haircut is pretty serious. So yeah, that's not gonna be the same for everybody, but I've seen numbers in that range.
Yeah, given that you can do, I mean, the numbers I saw, 24 acres with a single drone, you know, you can do, you know, I think on your website, you know, and that's in an hour. You know, you kind of sit there and say, okay, well, you can do all of a lot of land of corn or grain or something with these things and avoid soil compaction with for like right now you're doing fertilizer, herbicides, pesticides, anything else? Am I missing one? Oh, fungicides.
Yeah, pretty much everything. The one thing we don't do is your pre-season heavy like NPK fertilizers, because that typically calls for at least a few hundred pounds per acre. Yep. So that is definitely better done with some sort of like large ground rig typically. That's but everything else, so mid-season, late season, all the sides, pesticides, fungicides, herbicides, insecticides, etc. Yeah, what drones are great for. Foliar feed fertilizers too, so stuff that you would do again when the crop's already up, so maybe like some micronutrients, zinc or something to that effect.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's tear this apart a bit, because the precision part is interesting. So I'm going to start with one question, which is crop spraying. You got electrical lines along one side of the field. How much can a standard crop sprayer, an aerial crop sprayer, manage to get in there versus your drones? Because that's one of the key edge conditions, I think, right?
Yeah, you're right. And again, this is very contextual, but you're probably missing 10 to 20% worth of the edges of the field. If you're these pipes have to pull up right where the power line is. Yeah. So you're pulling up well before the power line, so you don't risk killing yourself. So there is that whole edge of the field where you're just not able to get any effective efficacy or spray down to where it needs to go. So yeah, another thing that's cutting into your yields if you're using airplanes. So I guess with an airplane, of course, you're avoiding soil compaction. That's good, but you're losing out on this lack of precision, or due to this lack of precision, I should say. And go on.
What's the wastage? I mean, I'm just, you mentioned flow over roads and other crops and stuff like that. What I feel like there's just part of the business case is you're going to spend 20% less on your products and your additives. I mean,
that's one thing. Yeah. There is research. Okay. I don't want to put the cart before the horse here, and I don't want to say anything that's going to get me into trouble, but I'll just say very, very vaguely, there is research that is probably going to come out later this year or early next year that is showing that with drones, due to the physics of the application, where you're spraying a much finer, like almost like a mist-like application, you're getting a lot better coverage and penetration with that chemically and physically. So with drones, you're actually able to get away with spraying, let's say, 30 to 50% fewer chemicals per acre than you would with an airplane or tractor. So not only are you covering more of the field, so you're not missing the edges like we just talked about with an airplane, you're covering more of the field, but you're using less chemical and overall volume. So overall solution volume to less water and chemical per acre. And that's anywhere from 30 to 50% savings in input costs for that application, which is huge. I mean, that's massive. So I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble. And
No, I won't hold you to this.
Yeah.
The paper will come out, it'll be peer reviewed, but that exceeds my expectations. And I'm, not surprised to find my expectations exceeded. I mean, I've, dealt a lot with aviation, as you can see from my computer generated electric aircraft and et cetera, on my backdrop here. But yeah, so I'm thinking through that. The wingspan of 14 feet, the wingspan of a crop duster is probably 30 or 40 feet with the spray nozzles.
Yeah, depends on the plane. Could be bigger, but yeah.
Yeah. And so the ability to, I know that there's different speeds you can go at and different altitudes. Do your drones run lower than airplanes typically do?
I wouldn't necessarily even say that. Okay. I've seen a lot of crazy ag pilots that get pretty low. One of the key differences is that we do have a completely different like flight profile envelope, or whatever you want to call it. So airplanes coming in, it's typically traveling pretty dang quickly, right? So at least, let's call it like at least 40 knots, I think typically faster. So you're dumping payload and then you're just leaving. And so it's really up to gravity and favorable conditions, hopefully in terms of wind stuff, to allow that spray to actually get where it needs to the intended target. Now with drones, you're traveling about 25 miles per hour, but you're traveling slower and you're also hovering over the area as you're spraying it, and you're using the downwash from the propellers to actually push all that down into the crop. So you're not leaving it up to chance or the environment being favorable. You're mechanically with the propellers pushing down the spray. So you're getting much more, or I should say your drift risk is much mitigated using drones because of that. And that's something that I think a lot of people overlook, like farmers that just aren't familiar with the space, but that's a really important factor. You're getting a lot more bang for your buck because of that.
Well, and how high above the crops do you normally fly? Is there a variance there depending on what you're applying?
Sorry, I didn't even answer that. But yeah, because of this downwash effect, you can fly at 15 feet above the crop and you're still not worried about drift, because we're talking about 400 pounds of downward force, 400 to 500 pounds. So even if you're flying 10 feet or 15 feet above the crop, it doesn't make much of a difference. It's still getting where it needs to go. Whereas an airplane, yeah, I mean, they might fly 10 to 15 feet as well, but they don't have that advantage of that downwash. That's the difference I'm trying to
explain. I'm thinking through it. Yeah, like Grant was talking to me about helicopters doing seed drops, and they just blew all over the place with no precision, landed on rocks, landed in water, blah, blah, blah. But that's actually not something I thought about. I'm thinking about the vortices behind a propeller propeller and behind the plane wings, because they are creating vortices behind that are not only pushing stuff down, but pushing stuff up. So as the stuff comes out, it's going in a chaotic fluid dispersal behind it, whereas your vortices are all straight down. You are pushing stuff in, which is actually, not something I'd thought about. Huh. Okay.
I'd say with the airplane, you're more pushing it out, right? It's kind of like a pigtails, like corkscrews.
And what that means is that you're going to end up with, if there's any lateral wind, you're going to get a lot more drift laterally than with your application.
That's right. There's just not enough downward vector force there.
Was this a bit surprising for you when you found out you could run it at 10 to 15 feet? Because my initial first principles assumption was you'd be running closer to the crops. What was your original thinking versus how you arrived at 10 to 15 feet? Or did you always know this?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's pretty obvious when you just get out there and just do it once, because you can see. you'll just see, again, the spray just going straight down. And it is, I mean, probably you're protected, I would venture to say, like 20 to 30 feet even above the crop. You would still have, let's say, 90% or more of your spray going straight down below the drone. These are just rough numbers, depending on the droplet size, the humidity, et cetera. But I would venture to say something like that. So it's something that once you see it, you're just like, oh, okay, that totally makes sense. Yeah. We do not need to be super careful about the altitude on these things. But I will say, yes, a lot of farmers, for sure, because they're used to worrying about drift, were wanting us to fly really low. Like before they had even seen the drone spray, we said, hey, we're going to come spray your crops. Like, how high are you going to fly? Can you please fly at 4 feet, 5 feet? And we had to explain to them, no, that's actually not necessary. You'll see. And then they saw, and then they got it.
Yeah, it is interesting because, some of those chemicals, you just don't want them on human beings. To your point about the, people in Costa Rica doing it with spreading them with their hands and stuff. There's some stuff in there that's just not healthy, like ammonia-based fertilizer. Let's start tearing apart the downstream implications of this, because there's the implications for the farmer, which is, 30 to 50% lower expense for the various additives and field stuff you put on the field. Everybody listening, don't quote him on this until the peer-reviewed study comes out and gives the real numbers. But the question there is, the next piece is, as we think about the downstream, so agriculture right now is a climate change problem, as well describe it. It's a necessary evil to feed everybody. But that necessary evil is based upon the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution is based upon fossil fuel-based ammonia fertilizers and a bunch of other stuff. And fossil fuel-based fertilizers, basically they do steam reformation of natural gas, or they take coal methane and they steam reform it with lots of energy, typically from methane itself, and they make hydrogen. And that produces 8 to 10 pounds for natural gas. So every pound of hydrogen comes with 8 to 10 pounds of CO2 for steam reformation. And for coal, it's every pound is, 10 up to 35 pounds, 20 to 35 pounds, depending upon the quality of the coal. So that's a climate problem to make the hydrogen. The hydrogen that gets taken and put into ammonia plants, where it gets combined with nitrogen from the air, because we're all breathing 78% nitrogen, to make NH3, you know, nitrogen and three hydrogens. That's right. I had to think about that one for a second, which is ammonia, which, you know, when heavily diluted, we can clean stuff with, but we use aqueous ammonia, somewhat diluted ammonia directly, and then we make ammonia and phosphate fertilizers as at mixed stuff. And then we put the ammonia on fields so that the nitrogen gets into the roots. That's back to that nitrogen fixing problem. And so there's this entire fossil fuel industry thing. 30 million tons of hydrogen get manufactured every year just to turn into ammonia. And then we put it in the field. And then we have problems with that, because when ammonia goes onto a field, this is something I learned more about the Pivot Bio Grant Carson Temme guy. When ammonia gets put on a field, it makes nitrous oxides, which have global warming potentials of 265 times CO2. So the combination is like, for the best case scenario, 10 to 12 times the mass of fertilizers get put in a field in terms of CO2e, right? So every extra ton of fertilizer we put in a field is extra tons of global warming stuff. So we've got to fix that. And I'm big on precision agriculture as one of the levers to do that. So when I talk to people like you, you know, it's like, oh, 30 to 50%. And you're doing not the heavy spraying, but you're doing the four times of spraying for extra fertilizer runs. That's a big difference in terms of climate change. You actually have a CO2e. So do you count that? Do you actually count that in how you think about this? Or are you going to start to count that and tell people about that you're a climate winner?
I'm really careful about that, because everybody knows our batteries, for example, are quite dirty to make at this point. The LiPo batteries that we utilize in EVs and drones, in any of these, you know, heavy duty vehicle type applications. Yeah, it's okay. I say dirty. It's not the cleanest thing, right? It's hard to put a number exactly how dirty LiPo manufacturing is. But the point is, it's going to get better. At least I believe it's going to get better. As an optimistic engineer, you need to put money into an industry to clean up the refining processes, I should say, and the manufacturing and all that. But yeah, I'm not going to tell anyone right now that, oh, you know, Helio is for sure this carbon neutral or even carbon negative force in the world, because I don't truly believe the industry is there yet. In terms of like all the stuff that goes into it, but it will be. It will be. I think. Yeah, and maybe you disagree with me. I'm not a climate scientist, so I'm probably speaking at a turn here. But yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if we're still not there yet. But I think
that's what you sell yourself on.
Yeah, it's way better potential. I mean, cars, ICEs will never get there, but at least drones have the potential to get there, right?
Well, anything that runs on electricity gets more virtuous with every passing year as more renewables enter the grid,
yeah,
and less fossil fuels are built.
Thank you for listening to Clean Tech Talk. Join us next time to get your electric fix. If you would like to sponsor our podcast, send us an email at accounts@cleantechnica.com. That's accounts@cleantechnica.com. Thanks.